So today we are continuing a series looking at the life of King David in the Old Testament. And just before we jump into the message for today, I want to let you know about two groups that are getting underway here very shortly. And we recognize there are some difficult and challenging times in life. And these groups are ways that we can recognize you do not have to walk through those times alone. And so there's grief share and also divorce care that are getting underway here very shortly. And if you want to be a part of that or you have any questions about that, text the word groups to that number there and we'll be in touch with you, answer any questions that you have or just get you connected with that. But I hope that you know you do not need to be alone. So let's turn our attention to the message for today. And if you've been with us through this series, or maybe you know the story of David to some degree, you know that his highest high was the day when the shepherd boy in a one-on-one battle took down the 9-foot giant Goliath. And they were singing songs about him, and it was the story probably that so many look back on for so long. Well, today we're going to look at the flip side. And we're going to see a giant that took down David. And this is not a giant that was out there and was not 11 feet tall, and maybe that's why he took him down. This is a giant that lived inside the heart of David himself. And if that was the highest point of his life today, we're going to look at the lowest point of his life. And this is a heavy story, and we mentioned this, Pastor Mike mentioned this before, but if you came in late, if you have children in here, this is sort of an adult topic we're going to look at today. We're not going to be inappropriate anytime, but we always want to make sure parents have the choice of what their kids hear. And in children's ministry today, they're not going to be talking about an adult topic. So you have the opportunity there to make the choice. Now, because this is heavy, let's start with something a little bit light. And I don't know if the name Rogers Cadenhead means anything to you. Probably not. Didn't mean anything to me until a couple of weeks ago. But you probably have heard, you know, that there are website domains, and there are some people that are referred to as domain hoarders. And what they will do is they will go out and buy domains very cheaply. They're often, you know, just, you know, a couple bucks or something like that, in the hopes that they get the domain name that somebody actually wants later, and then they can sell it to them at a greatly marked up price. Well, Rogers Cadenhead heard that there was going to be a new pope, and so he went and bought very cheap all of the websites that he thought might be wanted, you know, under this new pope and in kind of the web of the Vatican and the Catholic Church and all of that. Well, guess what? He guessed right. And so when the new pope was installed, they said, "We want that website," and they knew that he had bought it. But Rogers Cadenhead is a Catholic, a member of the Catholic Church, and he felt really bad about that. So he's like, "Well, I'm not going to charge them," and they were willing to pay a lot for it. But he did have a couple of requests, some things that he wanted in exchange for the website that he now owned. And he had three requests. The first one of those hats, right? You can't just buy those hats, right? I mean, they're really hard to come by, so okay, I want one of those hats. Number two, a free stay at the Vatican Hotel. I didn't know there was one, but apparently it's pretty nice. And I find a third one very interesting. Complete absolution, no questions asked for the third week of March of 1987. And I think inquiring minds want to know what happened in the third week of March of 1987. And here's what I think is probably common to everybody here in this room, that we all have a third week of March, that as we look back, we would say, "Oh man, you know what? That was my low point. That was the part of my life that if I could undo it, I would go back in time and I would undo it." And to this point in the story, David has been like this, well, superhero. And the mistake that we can make in the human experience is to think, well, there are two categories of people. There are the good people, and then there are the bad people, and there really is a solid line between those two. And there are so many parts of our culture today that reinforce this idea, right? You have somebody good, and you have somebody bad. You have a hero, and you have a villain. And in another context, you have somebody who's trying to save the world, and you have somebody who's trying to blow the world up. And then you also have somebody who's trying to get rid of the ring that is so dangerous. And then you have somebody who's gone completely dark. But could it be that the human experience is not that clear cut? And that instead there's this fuzziness, this darkness that can linger in the human heart, not meaning that everybody is as bad as they could possibly be in every moment, but meaning this, that try as hard as we want, we can just never measure up even to our own standards, much less the standards of a holy God. And so a question maybe as we begin, who am I in and of myself, on my own, who am I? And it would be easy for us, you know, maybe to put ourselves in one of those two categories, and my guess is we all want to be in the category of those who are good. But could it be that the answer to that is a little bit muddier, a little bit fuzzier than we would like? Here's one of the statements about reality that comes out of the Bible. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it? And that's a rhetorical question at the end. The answer is implied in it, and then the answer is nobody. And sometimes, I don't know about you, that the motives that I think are good and right are really not. And they're self-serving. And they're selfish. And so we're going to jump into the story of David, who's been a hero to this point. And it'd be really easy for us to say, well, we thought he was a hero, but now I guess he's gone to the dark side. Could it be that maybe there's something that lingers in the heart of every person that we all need to understand? So let's jump into the story. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, did you know that there was a war season in the ancient world? And in winter, things are muddier and wetter, and it's difficult to conduct battles, but then weather gets better, and so they would go out to battle. David sent Joab, that's one of the commanders of his army, and his servants with him, and all Israel, and they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem. It's the first time that we see a statement that says the king of Israel did not go out with his people, with his army to fight. They've been winning one battle after another. The nation has never been larger and more secure. But on this day, David chooses to stay in Jerusalem. And it's kind of a big deal for a couple of reasons. I'm thinking one of the aspects of life that we desire, and maybe I'm speaking more to guys, and ladies, you can decide if this is a temptation for you, but I think it is for us guys. If I could get to the place of complete autonomy, where I don't have to answer to anybody, and I can do whatever I want. Man, that would be living. This story is going to tell us, you know what? That's not the worthy goal that we think it might be when we don't have it. Because David now is autonomous. He can do whatever he wants. But also, he's disconnected from the people that he's logged a lot of time with. He's fought in a lot of battles with his men. But now he's not with them. He's all by himself. So what happens when somebody is completely autonomous and completely disconnected from the people that know them best? What could possibly go wrong? It happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and he was walking on the roof of the king's house that he saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. And after that, David sent and inquired about the woman. And one said, this is one of his servants, this is one of his payroll people, said to the king, is not this Bathsheba the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite? And I think there's a couple clues in here that this unnamed servant is trying to help the king in this moment. He's trying to wave a yellow flag in the face of the king. You're inquiring about her. Do you not know she's somebody's daughter and she's somebody's wife? Why do you want to go down that road? Who is Eliam? We find out later. He's one of David's mighty men. That was a specific title given to the 37 warriors closest to David. This is one of the people that he's gone out to battle with, one of the people that he's trusted him to have his back and vice versa as his daughter. And who is Uriah the Hittite? We find out he too is one of David's mighty men. One of the people that he trusts, and one of the people that trusts the king, and this is his wife. We find out also a little bit later that Bathsheba is the granddaughter of a guy named Ahithophel. And Ahithophel is David's right-hand man, like his counselor, wise and discerning. This is one guy who can see like 12 chess moves ahead of everybody else. And so when David needed advice, hey, what if we do this? And he would give him wise counsel. It's his granddaughter. So who is Bathsheba? She is the daughter of James Bond, the wife of Jason Bourne, and the granddaughter of Sherlock Holmes. And David sees her, and he sends for her. And somebody's trying to wave a yellow flag. You do not want to go down this road. So David sent messengers and took her. And she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she had been purifying herself from her uncleanness. Then she returned to her house. Now, I think there's an opportunity in this story for us to think, well, you know, it always takes two to tango. And what about, you know, her whole responsibility in where this is going? And this kind of curious detail here in the story, I think, is really trying to help us understand there's not one hint of a finger being pointed in her direction. We go, well, why is somebody bathing on a rooftop? There's a whole bunch of rituals in the Old Testament and all kinds of direction given about those rituals, and this one included bathing in living water, which is either running water or rainwater. Where do you collect rainwater? On your roof. But I think the clue about this helps us to understand that what she is doing in that moment is an act of devotion and not an act of seduction. This story is only about a king, a man in a position of power, who uses that power and that position to sexually exploit a woman. That's what the story is about. And the woman conceived, and she sent and told David, I am pregnant. And all of a sudden, David has a problem on his hands, doesn't he? Because somebody else's wife is pregnant, and the child is his. So David now is going to use his power and his position to try to cover this up or to try to manage it and make it okay. And so he comes up with plan A. And plan A is, let me bring Uriah back. He went out with my army. I stayed by myself. He's out there. Let me bring him back and get an update on how the battle is going. And when he's at home, he'll stay here for a couple days. He'll go home and he'll do what husbands and wives do. And then he'll be bad at math and not, you know, really understand how long this is. And then he'll just assume that the child is his. And so David brings him back. But Uriah has a different moral compass than David. Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house. When they told David, Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, have you not come from a journey? And why did you not go down to your house? Uriah said to David, the ark and Israel and Judah dwell in booths, in tents, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then I go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? He's saying, hey, I'm committed to the men. And if that's what they're experiencing, why should I, you know, have it easy when they have it so hard? And what began maybe as an opportunity to say, well, you know, let's just take a little step here to cover this up, it doesn't work. And so what we see in David's story is that he progressively becomes more serious about trying to manage this, and it's going to get really scary. After plan A doesn't work, he comes up with plan B. And while Uriah is still there, back from the front lines, he says, hey, why don't you come over to the palace tonight and let's have some drinks. Let's have some shots. Check this out. And David invited him and he ate in his presence and drank so that he made him, Uriah, drunk. And in the evening, he went out to lie on the couch with the servants of the Lord, but he did not go down to his house. And right now, one of David's men is so much more in touch with character than the king who has experienced so much grace from God. And now it gets real scary. Plan C. I tried, but I guess I have no options left. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. In the letter, he wrote, set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting and then draw back from him that he may be struck down and die. And he hands that death sentence to the guy to whom that's going to happen. And it's real easy for us to think, man, he went from hero to villain. He went from good to bad. I mean, to this point, you know, he's wanted somebody else's spouse. He's lied about it. He's now going to commit murder. I mean, he's working on all 10 of the 10 commandments here that are going south. And David hands a letter to that guy. And sure enough, Uriah takes it. He doesn't open it, hands it to Joab, and they carry out this battle plan, and they put Uriah up there, and then they withdraw, just as David said. And it actually tells us the detail that several people died, not just one. It's a bunch of collateral damage there beyond just singling out one. And on the other side of that, you think of a heart that gets really dark. David says to the messenger when he hears the news, "Hey, we tried to carry out this battle. It didn't go well. Several people died, including Uriah the Hittite. Thus shall you say to Joab, do not let this matter trouble you, for the sword devours now one and now the other. Strengthen your attack against the city and overthrow it and encourage him." Hey, that's war. You know, things happen. And unfortunately, people die. When in fact, David, you set the whole thing up. How dark is his heart right now? When the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she lamented over her husband. And what David did has this ripple effect in the hearts and lives of many people. And when the mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. And at this moment, I have to think David's thinking, "Whew, I got away with it. Now, no one is ever going to know. I made it. It was hard. There was a price to pay along the way, but I made it." But did he? There's one more sentence in that chapter. "But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord." Oh yeah, the Lord. Do you know how many times the Lord is mentioned in this chapter before that last sentence? Zero. No one's talking about him. No one's thinking about him. It's just this dark story. And literally, the Lord is the last word. And it helps us understand whatever the situation is, the Lord gets the final word. And now, God is going to enter into the story. Chapter 12 begins with this sentence, "And the Lord sent Nathan to David." Who is Nathan? Nathan is the prophet through whom God would communicate messages to the king. And if I were going to cast Nathan and what happens next here as a character, I'm going to date myself here a little bit, and maybe I've got some people in the room who understand what this is. I would cast Peter Falk as Columbo. How many people know who that is? And you know what I'm talking about. These are the old people in the room. Thank you. These are my people. If you don't know, ask your parents. They've seen this. But Columbo acted a little bit less than sharp, but he was brilliant. And maybe because of that, you know, kind of, "Oh, you know, I don't really understand things," it would lull these perpetrators into a sense of security, and then he would nail them. And so maybe in this scenario, "Oh yeah, king, you know, I got this situation. I don't really understand. It just boggles my mind. I've never seen anything like it. Maybe you can help me with this. Because the king is not, you know, just the king over the armies. You also act as judge. And so I've got this case. I've never seen anything like this. And maybe you can help me out here, king." And that's a terrible impersonation, but it's the best that I can do. But here's the story that he tells. "Now there were two men in a certain city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had very many flocks and herds," and the exaggeration is there. He's got more than he could possibly want or need. He's got everything. "But the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb, which he had bought. And he brought it up, and it grew up with him and with his children. It used to eat of his morsel and drink from his cup and lie in his arms, and it was like a daughter to him. He's raising it like this cherished pet. But then, now came a traveler to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take one of his own flock or herd to prepare the guests who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him." What do you think of a situation like that, king? And we know that Nathan's kind of setting the trap, right? And David walks right into it. David's anger was greatly kindled against the man. He said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, the man who has done this deserves to die, and he shall restore the lamb fourfold. He's so angry, he even gets the order wrong. He should die, and then he should repay. I don't think that plan's going to work, David. If he's dead, I'm not sure he can repay. And he shall restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and because he had no pity. And David, in his self-righteous anger, thinks, just bring somebody like that before me and I'll show you the kind of sentence we need to carry out. And then Nathan springs the trap and says, you are the man. And it doesn't tell us what David felt inside of himself in that moment, but all of a sudden he realizes God knows, and soon everybody's going to know. And everything that I tried to do to cover it up, no, it's there. And God sees it. And God knows. And Nathan goes on after these words to recount so many of the things that God did to work in David's life. You were a shepherd boy. Nobody gave you a chance to be of any value. God chose you. And God established you. And God provided for you, and God went before you, and God gave you great victories. God gave you so much. And the chapter of David's life where he is in touch with God and honoring God, he recognizes God's grace, and there's great gratitude in his hearts, and he recognizes his grace upon grace and gift upon gift, and there's gratitude. But in this season, he doesn't even remember the Lord. And he's not thinking about God. And when we don't recognize the grace and the gratitude evaporates, those hearts of ours can do some things that we never thought they could in different times. And David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And if there's one glimmer of light in David's heart and story at this point, it's the fact that here he does not point the finger at anybody else or anything else, but he owns it as his own. Not, well, what's she doing, you know, bathing on the top of a roof there? I have sinned. He owns it. I think there's a really good question for us to ask. Why is this story in the Bible? I mean, it's horrible. And there are so many people that are hurt by the actions of one. Why is this story in the Bible? A couple reasons. I think one, the biggest barrier to true righteousness is my own self-righteousness. And one of the reasons for this story is to convince us that if we ever think, hey, I'm off limits from anything like that. I mean, there's not even that potential in this heart of mine. If we get there, we're in a dangerous place. Because these human hearts contain the seeds of so many things that under the right circumstances can produce something that we never thought in a different season. And the Bible portrays it this way, that through one man, sin entered the world. And ever since that time, all the way back to Adam and Eve in a garden, on the other side of that, these hearts of ours are bent and broken and twisted. And it doesn't mean that we're the worst person that we can always be at all times, but instead, try as hard as we might, we just can't measure up to our own standards, much less God's. And there is this fuzziness about the image of God, and that is good. And all people still carry that broken image. But there's also the reality of the darkness of sin. And both of those things are true about all of us. It's the truth about us. And the aha moment in the story, and maybe this is not just Nathan speaking to David, but it's the word that we can hear to each one of us. You are the man. That potential is inside of me. And it's inside of you. And it's so easy for us in moments like this to stand back and to judge somebody like David who has made a horrific decision and all that comes along with it. But in those moments, and maybe it's not the same circumstances, and God willing, it's not, to say, well, if you knew this and that and the other thing. And so let's not play that game. Instead, let's take a look real fast at three realities from this story, three things that we can take away and apply to these lives of ours. The first is about the reality of sin and how sin is real, pervasive, and powerful. And there was a time in David's life prior when King Saul was still there, and there was this whole thing playing out about David waiting his turn to become king. And David, I think, makes the mistake of having those categories. Well, there are good people and there are bad people. As the Proverbs of the ancient says, out of the wicked comes wickedness. Well, you know what it is. Evil people do evil things. And I think conversely, you know, he probably left out this whole idea. Well, and good people do good things. And do you know where that proverb is? Is he quoting somewhere else in the Bible? No, it's not found anywhere. And the reality is that the experience of the human heart is fuzzier than just good and evil. That there is this mixture. And what it points out to us is that first and foremost, we need a rescue from a God who is greater than that. And day by day, we need the power and the presence of God to deal with this struggle, this tension, this battle that is inside of the human soul. And we often desire to do good, but even sometimes our best desires go bad. These words were written from somebody who once upon a time in his life, David wrote this, I delight to do your will, O my God, your law is within my heart. So was that just blowing smoke? No, I think David meant that when he wrote it. But you know what? Our hearts can run hot and cold, can't they? Tim Keller, a pastor and an author, says this, this story teaches us that the seeds of the most terrible atrocity live in every human heart, in the best people, even the people who are converted by God. And so the best place to be is to realize that there is this struggle, this tension, this battle, and I need God every moment of my life. That's just the reality about me. Something else that comes along from this story, David stared from his rooftop, right? And we think, well, I'm not going to be up on a rooftop staring, so I guess, you know, I'm off limits from this whole thing. Would you agree with me that today we have a virtual rooftop? We can stare at anything we want, and it can be sexual, but it doesn't have to be that. Maybe it can be something that we want, something we want to acquire, something we want to shop for, but we can't afford it, and we can't have it. It's the same dynamics, just with different circumstances. And so let's acknowledge the reality about our hearts and the seeds that live there that under the right circumstances can get dark. Second reality from the story, all actions have consequences for good or bad. And in this story, David's actions reap a tremendous cost in the lives of other people. We're going to discover next week, not only does it affect him and his family, it affects the whole nation of Israel. Check out what Nathan says. David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said to David, the Lord has also put away your sin. You know what? There is forgiveness when there is real ownership and real confession. You shall not die. Nevertheless, and he goes on to talk about your family is going to live by the sword after this. And there are going to be consequences in the nation. And the story after this is not one of the great seasons of David's life. All actions have consequences. We'll look at more of that next week, but I don't know about you. I could use some good news after all that heaviness, and here it is. No one is beyond redemption. I think that's another reason this story is here. Because I think we might be tempted, if there is good and bad, to put ourselves in the good category, but I know that there are some people who would say, you know what, if there are only two categories, I'm in the other one. I'm in the one that's off limits. I'm in the one that's blown it. I'm in the villain category. And I think this story is here to tell us, if you think that, you are wonderfully wrong. And that God's grace is bigger than your sin. What's the road back for David? Let me give you three words. The first is confession, right? He owns it and he says it. He doesn't make it about everything else that's happening around him. He owns it. And then there's repentance. Repentance is not just feeling really bad. It can include that, but it means taking your life and turning and going in a different direction altogether. Not doing the same thing over and over. And then also restitution. Taking responsibility for his actions to the best of his ability, trying to make things as right as possible. And sometimes it's really hard. We discover that ultimately David really honored what Nathan did in coming and confronting him. David and Bathsheba go on to have four sons. Solomon is the most famous one. He's the king that follows David. Then there's Shemua and Shimei. And in case you're looking for some baby names, those are available for you to choose from there if you want them. You know what the fourth one is named? Nathan. Nathan. He names his son after the man who came and confronted him. Maybe because he came to realize in time, as hard as it was in the moment, I needed that. And who knows where my life could have gone without that. David wrote about this whole experience, and we're not going to have time to look at all of Psalm 51, but as you see in the introduction, this is written after Nathan comes to him and confronts him about what happened. Have mercy on me, O God, according to my commitment to do good things after this day. According to my turning over a new leaf and being a better man and getting more serious about you. No, David doesn't do any of those things that are reliant on him, right? His focus and his attention is on the character and the nature of God. Have mercy on me because of who you are, God, according to your steadfast love. Not according to my desire to do more good things in my life than bad things, because they will outweigh those bad things that I've done. No, according to your abundant mercy, blot out my transgressions. There is hope. There is healing. There is forgiveness. And David comes to realize that, you know, what God is looking for is not people who work really hard on his behalf, but instead a broken and contrite heart, a broken spirit you will not despise. And then finally, he says, create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit in me. God, don't help me to start a new chapter. I need the God who spoke the universe into existence out of nothing to create a new heart inside of me, something that I cannot do. God, you can do. And so, God, will you do that in me? There's a temptation for us to overestimate our goodness. And maybe in the moments when we are called to account to make it about someone and something else. And I think this story tells us, be careful. Because the reality of the human heart is that the seeds of darkness are there for every single one of us. And we need to take that battle, that tension very seriously. We need God every moment of every day. And there are those who underestimate the capability for God to redeem and to restore. And I think this story is there to tell us, be careful there too. To write yourself off when God has not. And you are not beyond the reach of God's grace. No one is beyond the reach of God's grace. You are not beyond the reach of God's grace. Would you pray together with me? So God, thank you for being honest with us. Thank you for capturing this story and giving it to us so that we can understand more about us. And I think for us, and I know for me, the news about us, the news about me, is worse than I hoped it would be. But at the same time, the truth about you is better than we ever hoped. And God, help us to hold those two things in tension. And help us to honor the God who loves us as we are, not as we should be. And there can often be a big gap between those two things, who we are and who we should be. But may we hear your words that invite us to come. Come as you are. And there's a God who is able to create in us a new heart, to do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. And so God, if we tend to overestimate our goodness, give us the gift of humility. And if we underestimate our potential for redemption, help us to understand your great value for every human heart and soul. And God, as you have given us direction, may we act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with our God. Lead us in that direction for your name's sake, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.